It's a great pleasure to be invited here. Let me start my talk with some motivations why I started to work on this. This is about, I have given the conversation last night, the dinner. People talking a lot about the US government deficit and possibly maybe Japanese government deficit. And so I after the dinner, I sort of picked up some slides from my seminar notes, although they are in Japanese. And maybe I spent only a little bit of this to motivate my study. Okay. So this is, I'm going to show you, this is the household financial assets in the year between 1997 to 2009. And this is in the order of, okay, this is in trillion yen. So everyone should, at this moment, it's like one US dollars is about 80 Japanese yen, okay? So this is how much the Japanese household has as a financial asset, so in their balance sheet, the left-hand side. And this is around in the order of 1,400 trillion yen. That is in US dollars, about maybe 17.5, I don't know. You switched to US dollars. I'm used to talking about the Japanese yen. Okay, so, but it stays almost the same during the past almost 10 years, starting from like 1200, maybe 1300 to 1400 at this moment. And this is sort of the composition, breakdown of the financial assets of the Japanese household, and it's obviously about more than a little more than 50% of financial assets sits in bank deposits, and this is pension and life insurance. Life insurance is really a large industry in Japan. So households buy a lot of life insurance in Japan, and the next dark area is the equities. So you can see that the equity investment in Japan is not very much. It became a little bit larger in those years when the Koizumi government came out. But then after that, especially after Lehman crisis, it is now continuously shrinking down. So basically, the basic message from this picture is that Japan is a country where there is a huge financial asset sitting in the households, but they mostly sit in bank deposits. Okay, so that really is the motivation of our study. Okay, why Japanese households do not invest to stocks so much? And just for comparison, this is a Japanese household and the US household, the same thing. This is currency and bank deposits. Okay, about 50%, a little more than. And this is fixed income, mutual fund, and then equity, and this is insurance and pension. And this is the same picture for the United States. So only a little more than 10%, maybe 13% of household assets sit in currency and bank deposits. And this is fixed income, mutual fund, and the equity is this portion, and the life insurance and pension. So you can obviously see the big difference of the portfolios of household assets. Pardon? Last one, this one. This is others, miscellaneous. Yeah, others. Right. So let me stop on this one. And so I have some study group in Nomura Asset Management, which is a sort of asset management operation of Nomura Securities. And we meet sort of once in a while, I mean regularly. And one of the topics we have been talking, discussing is why the Japanese households do not invest to stocks. Mostly they invest in, they put their money in the banks, especially postal banks. And then those few financial institutions, they are the ones who invest to stocks, and also JGBs. So the issue is why the Japanese households do not invest to equities. And the other sort of aspect of it is that most of the equity holdings in Japan sits for all the generations, especially generation after age 55. A very, very small proportion is held by younger generations. And so it even increases after the age of 60. This is in the proportion of equity investment out of the financial assets. So it is very much in contrast to the United States, I guess. And so the way we used to understand why Japan is like this is, this is the main topic that we try to model it. But the idea is that, okay, everyone knows that Japan is a country with lifetime employment and also a very strongly age-dependent wage system, right? So especially when Japan was a young country growing very rapidly in late 60s and early 70s, maybe being employed by a company, you're assured of a lifetime employment, and it was like you're investing a lot of your financial assets into your labor, I mean into your job, right? So maybe for Japanese people, being a worker, being employed by a company meant a lot of equity exposures. So maybe it may not be necessary for Japanese households to invest a lot out of the financial assets into the equities. And rather, it may be more reasonable to put a lot of big proportion of their financial assets in saving bank deposits. So that is one perspective we had. And the other thing is that, okay, the other side of this observation is that when you are young, you have many years to work, and so you have a lot of exposures to equities, the fluctuations of the equity markets, because this is linked to your wage in the future. You know that you will be working with the same company, but the performance, what you get as a wage depends really on the performance of your company. So when you are young, you have a lot of exposure to the equity market. But when you get old, the retirement age approaches, then your exposure to the equities market through your labor income shrinks. So the other idea we have is that maybe for Japanese, young people have a lot of equity exposures through their through their workings. And when they get old, their exposure to the equity market gets smaller. And that may be one explanation why young Japanese do not invest a lot at all to equity market, and also why, on average, Japanese households do not invest a lot on stock markets. And then we know that this lifetime employment and age-dependent wages are changing quite rapidly these days. So in the current ongoing trend of the Japanese economy might have a big impact on this investment behavior that Japanese household used to have in the past maybe 20, 30 years. So that's where our model starts.
Yeah, I got it. Okay, thank you.
So I have the title, Human Capital as Age-Dependent Asset Mix and Optimal Life Cycle Portfolios. And human capital understand the Japanese households, you know, human capital should be viewed as the core wealth, and households' financial wealth should be structured as a supplementary portfolio to make up the most desirable form of the total wealth portfolio. So the key in understanding the life cycle pattern of household finance is to investigate the age dependence of the size of human capital as well as the risk characteristics of human capital as a function of wage age. So that is our problem. And I again start with the famous Samuelson-Martin paper under the CRRA utility functions. and the geometric Brownian motion on the security prices, you get the rule that the optimal portfolio weight should be a constant mix. You always invest a constant proportion of your financial risk to each financial asset. So that's very well known. And Marston, in 1971 paper, as already was mentioned, he introduced labor income into his model and showed that if we put the labor income into his model, then the optimal portfolio is still a constant mix of the overall wealth. If the lifetime flow of labor income is capitalized at the risk-free rate and added to the financial risk, this is already mentioned. So what this implies is that the share of bonds tend to rise with age up until retirement. Because you have a lot of, when you are young, you have a lot of fixed income in your human capital. Because it is now, Martin is assuming that a labor income is a certain stream, no uncertainty, non-stochastic income stream. So you have a lot of fixed income assets in the human capital. So when you are young, you should invest more in stocks and less in fixed income. That's what this you get from this analysis. Okay. So this sort of philosophy lies behind this target year, target date fund. Typical rule is that you invest 100 minus age percentage to the equities. So that's a very well-known sort of rule of thumb. And I just quote some picture from Bodhi's paper. The typical target year funds profile, age profile of investment into equities. And others, so far I talked about Martin, who introduced labor income in the form of non-stochastic streams. Okay. And other authors considered the effect of uncertain labor income streams and concluded that theoretical findings of Martin with non-random labor income should not be altered. And I list many papers. Those are the majority of papers in this area, which in common asserts that this optimal shape of equity investment is sort of decreasing function of age. So this is a sort of a picture which sort of shows how we see the essence of their model. Okay, so this is a human capital, and this is the age, and what do you have? The size of the human capital, when you are young, is very large, and as you age, it shrinks. And maybe in between, like when you are 30 or 35, it is the largest, depending on the age profile. The age goes up, the wages goes up until, say, middle age. So maybe you have a larger size of human capital around here. But anyway, the point is that it shrinks very fastly. Quickly, when you the retirement age approaches. And the other very important aspect of their model, those models, is that the proportion of risk exposures of human capital to the equity market is a constant. That is time invariant. Say, in other words, if, say, a human capital, when your age is 25, is like a 25% stock and 80% bonds, then still the human capital is 20% stock exposure and 80% to the fixed income exposure when you are 50 years old. So that is a sort of typical, very strong sort of aspect of those models which I cited. And our model it changes. The shape changes that when you are young, this proportion of equity exposure is very large. And as you age, this proportion shrinks. So that is sort of the aspect of our model. And it really depends on how you formulate the stochastic labor income stream. Okay. unlike liquid asset prices, movements of labor income are very sluggish and are more or less foreseeable in the short run. You know almost surely how much you will be getting this year, but you are very much unsure about how much you will be getting in 10 years beyond in the future. So the fluctuations of labor income over a horizon is very similar to the fluctuations of a balance of a money market account over time. It's usually called a cash bond. What is the sort of market value of cash bond? Except that the temporal fluctuations of labor income are driven by equity-related shocks, while the temporal fluctuations of money market balance, account balance, are driven by shocks in the short-term interest rates. So that's the difference. But the idea is very much the similar. Okay? When you look at the mutual fund investment, how much your balance will be in 10 years later is very uncertain. But how much will it be in half a year later is almost sure. Right? So the uncertainty changes a lot depending on your time horizon. Okay? And it's the same. When you talk about the human capital, okay, 10 years horizon, you have a lot of uncertainty in your labor income, but in a 1 year horizon, you're almost sure how much you're getting. So it's very much similar. So basically, we try to use the term structure models sort of to build up sort of the optimal portfolio problems. So the idea is this. Okay. So based on this motivation, most of the literature formulates the wage process as a diffusion process. Okay. So you have this finance variation process plus the diffusion process. So that's a typical, or in discrete time formulation, they use the AR1 process. So it's the same, basically the same thing. But our idea is that wage is sort of short-run certain process. It's a finite variation process. There is no diffusion term. But the growth rate, the instantaneous short-run growth rate of your wage has a lot of linkage to the equities market. So this mu TW, this is the expected rate of growth, short-run expected rate of growth of your wages. And this thing is a stochastic process which is driven by diffusions, Brownian motions, which is also correlated to the stock market. So that is the basic idea. So if you look at mu T as sort of short-term interest rate, and WT as the balance of mutual fund account, then this is really the sort of term structure model. And you can just formulate any models to express this mu T. This is the short-run interest rate in the case of interest rate models. And in our case, we can choose many ways, but our benchmark model is that we formulate we present this growth rate of wages as a Orenstein-Uhlenbeck process, and the Bacek process, mean reverting Gaussian process. And we sort of have a general formulation where this Brownian motion is a multidimensional. There are n dimensions of Brownian factors which drives this short-run growth rate. And there's another literature called, we call it the co-integration school. And in this school, there are a couple of papers which belongs to this school, and they have this idea. That is, okay, the wages and dividends or the stock prices are co-integrated. And there is some sort of co-integration relationship between those wages and stock prices. And therefore, when the time horizon is very short, then there is not enough period during which the co-integration effect makes a lot of influence. But if the time horizon, your horizon is very long horizon, then there are many years through which the co-integration effect makes a big effect on what you get when you get very old. So that is the idea in this school. And I just list a couple of literatures One paper is by Baxter and German, and they talk about home country bias. And they say that, okay, home country bias is this dilemma that people invest a lot, too much investment into their domestic equities. And they say that this dilemma gets more severe when you think about this co-integration. Because when you have a co-integration, this means that your human capital is more like a stocks. So you have a lot of already stocks. Then you should maybe short stocks in your financial investments. So that is quite contrary to this home country bias. So this perspective makes the home country bias even more serious. And there's another literature. This is, they talk about the asset side, human capital. But this literature, Lucas and Zelis, they talk about the liability side. Okay. So you think about the defined benefit pension plans, and they talk about the PBOs, projected benefit obligations. Okay. Then you have a lot of debts in your balance sheet. And that debt is very much linked to the equities market when you are young. If the company has a lot of young staff, young employees, then their payment in the future is very much exposed to the equities market. So you should invest to hedge against that PBOs. You should invest a lot into the stock market. But when you are the old company and most of your benefit payments are to retired people, then your obligation is mostly fixed income. And so you don't have to invest a lot into the equities market. So that's what they get using this co-integration model of labor income. And finally, there's a paper by Bentoni, Colin Diffray, and Goldstein in General Finance. And they also use this model of co-integration between dividends and stock prices. To assert that human capital tend to be quite equity-like when they are very, people are very young, but it becomes more like bond-like when people get very old. And from that, they derive a conclusion that the optimal investment into equities has a hump shape rather than the sort of monotone declining in ages. So we more or less get the same sort of result with a very different modeling. So co-integration versus our model. Our economic insight is different from the co-integration school since mean reversion is not the mechanism that creates age dependence of stock market exposure of human capital. Okay? So in our model, although we use a batch check type models to formulate the growth process of wages, it is not necessary in our modeling. But in their model, the co-integration, they need co-integration to generate their result. So they are very much sensitive against, well, they make a lot of sort of excuses. When they are test co-integration, they cannot get very strong co-integration in structural testing. So they make a lot of excuses for this. But we don't have to do it. And from here, it's just we sort of get assuming the complete complete market. That is, if you can hedge your human capital or the labor income perfectly, you have a complete market. Okay, then you have a very clean analytical solution for this problem. And we use instead of Bellman equations, we use the so-called Martingale method and also Maria van Kerkhove to arrive at the cross-home solution. By the way, it is very, very fitted and suitable for this case. I mean, in order to, our focus is to see the exposure, equity exposures of the human capital. Okay? And to analyze those equity exposures of human, how does the equity exposure depend on the age? To solve that problem, to approach that problem mathematically, it is very sort of suitable to use the idea of Maria van Kerkhove. Because Maria van Kerkhove is sort of, you are interested in volatilities of things. So we use that technology to solve this problem. And so this is what it is. And let me go ahead and let me see what we achieve. Okay. So in the simulation, I will show you the simulation result, but in the simulation, we assume that interest rate is a constant, and also there is no mean divergence. So the mu's and sigmas of securities are constant, joint branding motions, and also we assume a constant interest rate. So there is no hedging against stochastic opportunities. And the shortcoming of this simulation is that then, because we are not assuming the short-term interest rate is stochastic, it's constant, we are assuming. Then there is no difference, you cannot differentiate between cash investment and fixed income investment. So you are essentially having a two-way asset allocation rather than a three-way cash, bond versus equity asset allocation. So, and obviously we also use a CRRA consolidated risk aversion and utility function to arrive at a very clean closed form solution. And let me, before, rather than going into those pages, let me just go ahead to the sort of the result. What kind of thing is that? Those are the equations, the closed form solutions for the problem. And this is sort of a solution. Okay. This is a sort of how much, what is the market value of human capital? And assuming this structure of our short-run uncertain labor income process. And this is in contrast to the page which I had a more colored screen that I had at each age, there's 20% equity and 80% fixed income exposure. Then it's the same throughout the age. That was the previous page. But in this page, this is the outcome of our model. Then when you are 25 years or 30 years, your exposure to the equity market is like 80%. But it goes down up to like 0% when you are at the age of 64. 65 is the age when he retires. So we have a sort of fixed. So in some sense, Stanley's paper had a constant or deterministic labor income, but so uncertain death time. In our model, we have a fixed retirement age, but uncertain labor income. So that's the difference. So anyway, the point is that we are getting this change of the exposure of human capital to the equities market, and it is declining in age. And that will produce this shape. This is very much extreme. And this, in this picture, we are assuming no short selling. You can short sell equities. Then actually what you are doing is during these years, until age 55, you are shorting equities. And then you start investing into the equity market at the age of 50. Well, this is just depends on the parameter. We can change it a little bit to this side. But anyway, the point is that you short equities when you are young, and you start investing into the equity market when you get middle age, and there is a hump there, and when you get very old, you decrease the exposures and investment into the equities market. So that's what basically we get. Okay. And then the final point is that, okay, so far in the previous simulation, we assumed that the market is complete. You can totally hedge, perfectly hedge your labor income risk by using a sort of combination of many securities that you can trade in the financial market. But now we change the assumption and assume that some portion of your labor income is not hedgeable using the financial securities. And we try to solve it under this regime. And so I sort of put some of the literatures which tries to solve those problems with a stochastic labor income, but with incomplete market, how do you solve analytically the optimal consumption and the investment decisions? And really, this is a very tough area to solve. And I quote some of the literatures who attacks this kind of problem, like those are the typical papers which proposes a solution method. But actually, the route to finding the state price density through those approaches are not very obvious at all. And there's one paper by De Temple and Lindy Bascher in 2005. They, under some restrictive assumptions, they show how to solve this class of problems with an incomplete market. But the problem, the difference between their work and our point of model is that they do not have labor income within this model. And if there is no labor income in this model, it is not very hard to solve mathematically the optimal solutions. But if there is a labor income, the complexity of the mathematical complexity of the problem changes. So I think that this is sort of an open area in the sense of mathematics. Assuming that this kind of labor, stochastic labor income and CRRA utility functions, can you derive a cross-form solutions for the optimal investment policy under incomplete information? And I think that is an open sort of problem. And we sort of derive the solution numerically in the case of incomplete information rather than getting the cross-form solutions. So this is a sort of numerical solution. Here, since we use a numerical sort of solutions, we put the no short selling conditions on stocks. So we have a more smoother lines, smooth profiles on investment in equities. This is because before we had you could short sell stocks. So you had minus investment in the stocks, and then it all suddenly goes into the stock market. But now we have, you cannot short sell stocks. Then your investment into stock market gradually increases and then starts to decrease. So this is a case when the market is almost complete. So that is, you can hedge almost perfectly using financial devices against your human labor income risk. But the thing which is shown here is that if the market is so incomplete, that you cannot really hedge your labor income using the financial instruments, then the story changes quite a bit. And then the optimal investment rule looks like a target year fund. That is, you invest a lot in equities when you are very young, and when as you age, you decrease your exposure to stocks. So the main conclusion of our model is that, okay, if there is a lot of opportunities to hedge, there are many, many securities, thousands of securities that you can trade in the market. And so combining those things, you may be quite able to hedge against your future wage profiles. If that is the case, then your human capital looks like what I said, like when you are very young, it's like 80% equities and 20% bonds. But as you age, it gets more like 20% stocks and 80% bonds. And so, therefore, you should invest a very few small amount into the equity market when you are young, and you increase your investment in equities when you get middle age. So you typically get a hump shape. This is when the market is quite complete. But if you cannot really hedge against those labor income risks, there aren't many financial sort of sophistications, then the target debt fund is what you should buy. So that's what that we get. Thank you.
So I'd like to thank Moshe for giving me the opportunity to read this paper, because I really enjoyed it. I think it makes an interesting contribution to the literature. Let me. Professor Kobayashi has already told you what's in the paper. Let me try to pick out a few things that I think you should take away from it. The paper starts by solving this optimal consumption over the life cycle problem in very, very general terms, using, as has been said, the Malleavant calculus, named after Paul Malleavant, who's a French probabilist who died this past June. Basically, the way the solution works is that one looks at the allocation to stocks, and one finds that that's the difference between two terms. One term would basically be the Merton solution to the optimal consumption problem, but using financial wealth and human capital as the using financial wealth and human capital as wealth. So basically, that would give you the Merton solution, basically a fixed proportion of financial wealth plus human capital as what one's allocation stocks would be. Well, that's one term. The actual allocation is a difference between that and another term, and what that other term stands for is exactly basically the equity component of one's financial capital. So the solution, I mean, the one term we understand, the term that really needs analysis in this case is exactly what is the equity component of one's human capital. This basic question is one that Moshe captured very, very nicely in the title to one of his popular books. The book's title was "Are You a Stock or a Bond?" And that's basically the question that Professor Kobayashi is resolving. He's saying, when we look at that equity component of human capital, are we looking at a person who's a stock or are we looking at a person who's a bond? So you can think of what the answer to that question is in a number of different scenarios. So the first scenario would be that labor income is entirely predictable, that there's no randomness associated with labor income. So in that case, the answer to the question is, this person is a bond. If that person is a bond, they should be putting a lot of their assets, or they start out life as a bond, and as they approach retirement, they become less bond-like because maturity date is fast approaching. And so what should they do? They should do exactly what these target date funds do with their glide paths. They should be exactly starting off with a high allocation to equities and then decreasing that allocation over time. So that's one example that's well understood. Professor Kobayashi goes on to look at a second example, an example where you model labor income using a geometric Brownian motion. So in the case, this is a model that I think people had analyzed before. If labor income is a geometric Brownian motion, what's the answer to the question, are you a stock or a bond? Turns out the answer is, whatever you are when you're young, you're the same thing when you're old. If you start out with labor income being a certain mix of equities and bonds, then as you approach retirement, you may have less time to run, but your mix between equities and bonds in terms of how you would think of your human capital, it basically stays the same. The answer is, some people are stocks their whole life, some people are bonds their whole life, but that doesn't change. The thing that's really intriguing about the model Professor Kobayashi builds is it's a model of how people would change what they are over the course of a lifetime. They would change the answer to that question. For the particular model that was introduced here, where there's essentially a deterministic growth in labor income. Labor income is a bounded variation process. It's basically growing in a somewhat exponential way. But where the randomness comes is in the growth rate. The growth rate is stochastic. The conclusion in the paper is that people whose lives are captured by this model, basically they start out as stocks, and they can become more bond-like over the course of their lifetime. So when they're young, they're stocks, and when they're approaching retirement, they're bonds. And this produces a very big change in what that equity composition of human capital is. That equity composition of human capital starts out being very high. They start out being very stock-like, which means that on the financial side, they should be holding very little stock. They should be shorting stock. They should be holding a lot of bonds. And then as they move through their lifetime, as they become less stock-like themselves, their financial holdings in equities should go up. And then at some point as they approach retirement, start coming down in line with the fact that the maturity of their bond is rapidly approaching. So what is the feature of the model that produces this interesting shift from I'm a stock when I'm young to I'm a bond when I'm old? The way I would understand it is in terms of the reaction of a person's human capital to fluctuations in the stock price. So remember that labor income is essentially growing exponentially. There's a growth rate. What influences the way things grow? Well, with an exponential function, there's a huge impact of what the initial conditions for the exponential function are. How much does it start out at? And if you think of what the impact of equity returns on a person's human capital is in this particular model, what happens is the growth rate fluctuates all the time. That means that, you know, there's going to be a random component to what a person earns when they're rather young. That fluctuation in what a person earns when they're young lives with them for their whole life. In fact, because of this exponential growth, the longer they live, there's this magnifying effect that takes whatever the changes that occur to someone's labor income when they're young, and basically that has quite a large impact on what their human capital is, what they're going to earn over their lifetime. So the impact of equity returns when they're young is actually quite large when you look over the lifetime and you're incorporating that effect that things scale up because there's a long time to run and exponential growth involved. As they move through the life cycle, there's much less of this opportunity for exponential growth to blow things up and magnify the effect. In fact, what the growth rate is mean reverting, and presumably what becomes much more important later in the life cycle is the level of mean reversion and not exactly how far you've moved away from it. The random fluctuations are important at the beginning. They're much less important at the end. What's happening at the end is much more driven by how much your labor income was able to grow, say, until middle age, and therefore you become more like a bond, and therefore your equity holdings should go up. So that's my somewhat superficial understanding of what the really fascinating parts of this model are, and how, in some sense, they explain the conclusions that come up. Professor Kobayashi then goes on to look at other versions of this problem in which maybe incompleteness in the market means that you can't really hedge the equity returns. And what happens in that case is that he gets an interpolation between these two states, between sort of the deterministic labor income model where people are always bonds, to the stochastic model in which there's this change over the life cycle, and you get sort of an interpolation between those two things. Where does one go from there? I was actually amused that Scott actually anticipated part of what I was going to say, because among the list of questions he posed was, well, you know, what someone should really do is go out and work on a problem where, yes, you have investment returns, yes, you have random deaths, so there's insurance and annuities, But we should also have stochastic labor income in there, that we should somehow take all of those effects and put them together. Well, Professor Kobayashi gave us a very nice exposition of what happens when you have this kind of problem with stochastic labor income. What happens when you put that together with a sort of Yari model of uncertainty in the lifetime? Well, what I would claim is that what you get when you put those together is a paper of my colleagues, Moshe Malevsky and Huashong Huang, which appeared in the Journal of Banking and Finance in 2008, in which there was exactly that. They were looking at, they were interested in insurance and annuities, and they were over the life cycle. What should people's consumption of insurance and annuities be over the life cycle? They were doing this in a context where there were investments, when there was random death, and when there was stochastic, labor income. So I think exactly the question you were asking, Scott. The context they were working in was somewhat different from that we heard about from Professor Kobayashi. In particular, they were using, Huashong and Moshe were using a geometric Brownian motion. So remember, that's the model that we heard that the answer to, are you a stock and a bond, is time invariant. That if you're a stock and a bond when you're young, you're still going to be a stock or a bond when you're old, and that's not going to change. It would be fascinating to put these two things together. It would be fascinating to say, if you're in a world where people evolve, where people start out as stocks, and then as they grow older, they become more bond-like, what's the impact of that on their need for insurance? What's the impact of that on the extent to which insurance really affects their utility? What's the effect of that on how much insurance they should buy? I think these are very interesting questions. These are questions that basically beg, certainly in the context of this conference, to be asked for the model that we saw introduced here. Huang and Malevsky observe that in their model, volatility of labor income and correlation of labor income with equity returns, those actually have a big effect on people's demand for insurance. This is one of their conclusions. That basically what happens is that as you increase volatility of labor income, or as you increase the correlation between labor income and equity returns, what happens is that the demand for insurance goes down. People need less. I mean, it sounds contradictory. In sort of a more uncertain world, people need less insurance. If you think about it a little further, that actually makes sense. In a more uncertain world, in a world where equity returns, where your labor income is much more volatile, the extent to which insurance can really reproduce your equity, your labor income returns, the extent to which insurance can somehow substitute for labor income is diminished. It isn't a good proxy for labor income, and so maybe adding insurance doesn't produce as much utility in that context. It would be fascinating to see if the same kind of conclusion held in Professor Kobayashi's model. If it did, one would expect that the demand for insurance at young ages would be lower in this kind of model as compared to a geometric Brownian motion model, and then it might go up for a while, and then presumably, just as with equity investments, it turns around that there would be a hump-shaped demand for insurance that was more pronounced than the geometric Brownian motion. So, that's an interesting question. I think there are a whole variety of interesting questions that are prompted by this work. And again, I'm very happy to have a chance to dig into it.